fossil fuels here in the Northwest. Bridge to Disaster, resisting frac gas in the Northwest. 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in Portland, 1211 Southwest Main. And we are just about out of time. Thank you, Jacqueline. We'll have you again, I'm sure, on before too long.
Definitely.
And we'll keep in touch with what you're doing. And so thank you, people, for listening. We only had one caller today, but I'm sure people were wanting to hear the words directly from Standing Rock about what's going on. And thanks to Lewis Grassrope for being on our program as well. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Stand Together, a day of action workshop Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Stand Together is a day of workshops for people new to social and political action and for those upgrading their skills. Sessions include digital security, photography for action, strategic planning, nonviolent direct action, legal basics, know your rights, and more. Again, that's Stand Together, a day of action workshop Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitary Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kboo.org.
And the time is 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. At the top of the hour, Project Censored Radio reports on the group Brand New Congress, a campaign that intends to field a citizen responsive candidate in every House district in 2018. And then at 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Recovery Zone looks at the benefits of soil carbon sequestration and regenerative agriculture. And we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're just a listener and not a member yet, you can become one when you go to kboo.fm on the web and click where it says Donate. We appreciate that. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting an evening with classical guitar quintet Los Romeros, a multi-generational family performing since 1958. Los Romeros performs Friday, March 10th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, and tickets and information for this all-ages event are available at portland5.com. And here we go with Project Censored Radio for today.
We want a smash, crash, blast, smash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared, this is the vision. Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nolan Higdon. Mickey and Peter will return in 2 weeks. On today's program, we will discuss themes of democracy, racism, and resistance. Our guests include Michelle Rodino Colasino of Union for Democratic Communications, Caitlin Remmel of the Incorruptibles and Brand New Congress, and later in the program, we will be joined by the legendary activist and artist Charlotte Hill O'Neill, a.k.a. Mama C. Please stay with us.
People together can overthrow the system. I got that love, but don't run.
politics of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my guest, co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III, and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. So, today is the general strike, February 17, 2017. People in 100 cities are participating in the Strike for Democracy. And the organizer said that they're organizing this strike in reaction to the ICE raids, travel bans, Trump's mobilization on the border wall, as well as the attack of workers and women, people of color, the LGBTQ community, and our environment. So it's a pretty wide scope. This is kind of looks like it's an attempt at the big umbrella movement that progressive organizations have talked about for quite some time. What news are you guys hearing about this?
First of all, I just wanted to say that I really appreciate the use of the term strike, because not only is it reminiscent of some of the movements in the left in Europe, but it also is an all-encompassing term, as you suggest, where we can take on wide-ranging issues like anti-immigration policies, the Trump administration, the critique of the media, all kinds of things that are going on. But we can also begin to incorporate what I think is going to start happening in this country, at least I'm hoping it will happen in this country, the rise of a new labor movement, especially as we begin to see the Trump administration and others pushing back against union organizing and pushing that right to work legislation.
And we already saw the Day Without Immigrants that made quite a splash nationwide. I think that was a pretty nice precursor to a more general strike, given as well with the policies coming down with Trump's new National Guard announcements trying to get rid of more immigrants to the country. How about if immigrants just go on strike and show their economic and political muscle?
We're lucky enough to actually have Michelle Rodino-Colasino from the Union for Democratic Communication. She's been active and participating in this movement. So, Michelle, nice to hear from you.
Great to be here.
So we're talking a little bit about the Strike for Democracy. What can you tell our listeners? What's going on?
It's going great. There are large events going on in New York, in L.A., in D.C., in Philadelphia, in West Philadelphia. In other places around the country, there's over 100 various events. Some of them are strikes. Some of them are demonstrations. People are doing boycotts and bicots, teach-ins, Skillshares. It's just really a patchwork and a quilt. And it's really neat. It really bubbled up from below with all of these people kind of finding each other on social media and making plans.
Can you talk a little bit about that? So this is such a broad scope that this is attempting to look at. Who are some of the organizations that are participating in this movement?
This is a beautiful thing as well, that Women's March and International Women's Day are both actually officially partnering with Strike for Democracy, which is the event that's happening today, and also a larger group. We're kind of hoping that Strike for Democracy becomes a movement, not a moment. I know that a lot of people are saying that for various movements, including Black Lives Matter and others. But we really hope that this will become a coalition, including Black Lives Matter. But for now, Women's March and Women's Day are both in solidarity for today's small action that's also hoping to be kind of an energizing moment, even a moment to kind of get together with people, ask for people's contact information, and see if they're ready to plan for an even larger mass strike. The next one being March 8th, A Day Without a Woman. And again, that's the mass strike being planned by Women's Day and Women's March.
Michelle, this is Michael Levitin hopping in. What do you see as the momentum or the new kind of openness to this idea of a general strike?
It's fantastic. And as I was waiting there listening, I was listening to you talking about how this might be an indication of a new labor movement. And I do think that it is. I think people are waking up. Again, you might have heard the phrase stay woke. I think people are waking up to the fact that they have power more than just at the ballot box, which unfortunately is sometimes taken away. You know, we saw in this last election the purging of millions of votes, the right to vote of millions of African Americans and Latina and Latinos and Asians. If you're familiar at all with Greg Palast's investigative journalism on the vote purge. So people are feeling beyond voting, there's other powers I have, even beyond marching and demonstrating. And one of them, a classic one, is the strike.
And have unions really, or labor and organizers, organizations been brought in, like say dock workers and other actual unions that could have put more muscle into this, or is that maybe coming up in the months ahead?
We're hoping that that's coming up in the months ahead. And as I'm sure some of your listeners are aware, there are laws like Taft-Hartley, which make it illegal for unions to strike in solidarity, you know, to do secondary strikes. You know, Taft Hartley was really designed in the mid-40s to end general strikes. And after that, labor had to get more creative for the great sit-down strikes that were effective. You know, auto industry did those and, you know, slowdowns and other actions. So I think what's happening today is just another kind of move in the development of creative actions people can take at work. You know, they can tweet during their lunch breaks. They can have a sick day. I know that some people actually asked their bosses to stay home, and their bosses were very supportive. We saw with Day Without an Immigrant, some restaurants actually closed, the management kind of being a leading force of that. You know, we're at a different point in time than we were, you know, in the 40s and the 30s and the teens when we saw general strikes last. So, yeah, it's really exciting. So hopefully we'll go forward, and hopefully going forward, unions and kind of what we, when we say big labor, we'll see large unions being able to mobilize their members. But of course, it takes a lot of planning, right, for that to happen. And this plan to have F-17, February 17 happen was really kind of thought of and just really a few weeks ago. So it's quite amazing that this just was able to happen, just given about 2 weeks of planning of really of people desperately doing a thing.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. We are recording this program on February 17th, the day of this general strike. And we are talking to Michelle Rodino-Colosino about the strike. Michelle, earlier you had talked about social media, and we always sort of hear these absolutes about how it's either the worst thing that's ever happened or the greatest thing that's ever happened. So I'm wondering, what's the importance of social media in organizing something like this large general strike?
Well, I've seen this be both kind of the best of times and worst of times for organizing. Social media is wonderful for making it easy for people to reach out and find each other, but the rub is you have to be on social media. So you're going to see a class of more privileged people, English-speaking people, and so you can't really easily organize people if they're not on Facebook and on Twitter or on Instagram, right? And so you're automatically cutting out some of the most vulnerable workers right there, and maybe people who don't speak English as the first language they speak and all of that. So I think it's a tool. I think it's a way to get started and get the ball rolling, and we just kind of have to keep going from there.
Michelle, what can you tell our listeners? What can people do to get involved in this for March 8th or any other movements coming off of this moving forward? What would you recommend for listeners?
Right, that's a great question. I would say one of our kind of slogans has been find your people, make your plan. And if you can't find people locally to get involved with, you can take a look around and maybe contribute just kind of like in the comment section, or register on one of those social media sites under a group maybe that's near you. We've been encouraging people to ask for people's names and contact information so they can be part of the next wave of action. So, for example, I teach out here at Penn State. We had a small demonstration, and I explained to people what we were doing and how we were hoping to build momentum for March 8th. And if they'd like to be part of that and help plan, if I could have their name and emails and their phone numbers, and everybody gladly gave it because they all want to be part of the Day Without a Woman being planned for March 8th. So I would say that's kind of the next step. If you can't get to an event, just look online and try to reach out to somebody. We'll all take your emails. If nothing else, you can always sign up at Strike for Democracy. We have a place where you can just register as an individual. So strikefordemocracy.com or strikefordemocracy.org.
Michelle, this is Dr. Baham. I wanted to ask you, I had a sense during the Women's March that there was this possibility of us as activists overcoming the balkanization of traditional Democratic Party politics. And personally, you know, I'm very prepared as a black man to be Latino, to be Muslim, to be a black male feminist. And I'm wondering if there's any sense with the organizing of the general strike that we're continuing to push in this kind of direction.
Yeah, so I think what you're asking is, are we approaching this kind of intersectionally?
Correct,
and trying to build a coalition? And the answer is yes. The answer is yes. Now, I have to say, I've seen a lot of white faces involved, and I hope that changes, and I hope that's more of an expression of the fact that a lot of people were mobilized on Facebook and says more about Facebook's demographics and Twitter's demographics than the demographics of the people that want to organize and need to organize. So I think that's going to be fine. And I think we are, I know a lot of us have been reaching out to various groups. Women's March in and of itself is a coalition, right? It's a vast coalition of 500 partners. And in working with Women's March, it's been really wonderful to see that Women's March has ties with labor, with Black Lives Matter, with community organizing groups that are intersectional. So it's sort of like coalescing with a coalition right there. So I think that everybody that showed up at my event, which, again, I saw a lot of white people at, we had all different kinds of signs. We had signs for women's rights. We had a Black Lives Matter sign, LGBT movements coming out. So it's really been a gratifying day.
Okay, Michelle, thank you for coming on the radio show today. And I know you're busy doing a ton of things. We really appreciate you having you on. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been really wonderful. Like I said, if anyone out there wants to get signed up or just find out more about what we're doing, check out our website, strikefordemocracy.com and strikefordemocracy.org.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. We will be back after this short musical break.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on, no matter what? Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffins, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The U.S. government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to shorties. And the nonsense that you're spitting, they just listen and absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been woken. I'm a giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apple and Oaxaca, and we hold the machetes. I rock hard like Palestinian children holding slingshots. I'm with every single.
Welcome back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nolan Higdon, in studio with our co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. And our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. Now we're going to switch over and talk about our headlines. As everyone knows, the Media Freedom Foundation does a bunch of work through the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, as well as ProjectCensored.org. And we like to highlight the great work that's being done. So Alicia Guajardo, our intern, is here. And Alicia, what's in the news?
I am Alicia Guajardo with the Media Freedom Foundation. Here are just some of the stories we're working on for you. Professor Watchlist, a racist violation of free speech by Peter Phillips. In this article, Dr. Phillips breaks down the racist implications of a list of professors created by Turning Point USA. This can be found at projectcensored.org.
Actually, Dr. Phillips does some incredible work on breaking down these lists, this list culture we're in now of, we'll just make a list of things not to pay attention to, like the Washington Post news list or these conservative lists of professors who hate America. And I have had a chance actually to read this article, and it's a really good article. He shows that basically if you're anyone who fights for racial equality or critical race theorists, you're definitely going to end up on this list. Okay, Alicia, what else do you have for us?
JCML.org, that is the Global Critical Media Literacy Project's website. Caitlin Ramsey, who's a student at Worcester State University, working with Dr. Julie Frechette, they published an article titled Victoria's Real Secret, Perfect Body Campaign. In the article, it argues that more than any other sociocultural force, corporate media defines one's body image, which is the idea of what one's body is or should be like. In fact, the American ideal of beauty has become so pervasive that 50% of 3 to 6 year old girls worry about their weight. There are 30 million people of all ages and genders that suffer from an eating disorder in the United States. And according to the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders, and out of these 30 million people, women make up 90% of that populace. Eating disorders tend to start in the teenage years, but can also start at the ripe old age of 8. And 80% of 10-year-old girls have dieted. Young girls are more afraid of being fat than they are of nuclear war, getting cancer, or even losing their parents. Why at such a young age do people develop such a devastating mentality?
This article from Dr. Julie Frechette's student, Caitlin Ramsey, is a really good one. She does a great job of displaying the negative effects of media. Sometimes people question, why are you so critical of media? But, you know, these are individuals who are changing all of their life choices, adding on these fears because of what they're seeing in media. So definitely a really important read. And I can just say Dr. Julie Frechette is someone I've had the privilege of working with, does some amazing work, as do her students. So I would check that out at gcml.org.
And also at gcml.org, Steve McCombs of California Maritime Academy, working with our host, Nolan Higdon, published Global Epidemic of Electronic Waste. The article discusses the epidemic of pollution and environmental degradation concerning electric waste, including how electronic waste, when recycled improperly, negatively affects local communities across the globe.
This article was a pleasure to work on because Steve McCombs is a great student, but also really sad reality to face, especially as we go through these more and more iPhones that come out and people throw away their old products. This is creating waste around the globe. And I think part of that discussion about media literacy, something I've been an advocate for, is we can't just discuss how to use these tools. We also need to look at the implications, not just on people's social norms, but also the environment of using these digital tools as well.
Okay, and finally, the educators and conscious consumers in our audience can visit gcml.org and find a free resource for educators and consumers, media literacy to assess and evaluate news and current events. Published by Dr. Allison Butler of Mass Media Literacy, the packet titled Post-Election, Post-Truth, Using Critical Media Literacy Skills to Evaluate the Current Post-Election News Environment, including Fake News, Satire, and Propaganda. It is primarily designed for librarians, but the document can be adapted for anyone interested in applying critical media literacy activities to support students, families, and community patrons as well.
Yeah, I want to say that Dr. Allison Butler does some phenomenal work, and you'll notice that a lot of folks use the term media literacy, but her and the others I work with use the term critical media literacy. And the reason that critical is so important because it allows us to ask questions of power. Who has the power to create media? Who's consuming media? Who has the power to disseminate media? And a lot of, you know, media literacy educators tend to take foundation funding from like Nickelodeon, Sony, Apple, and Microsoft. So they want to teach students how to use these tools and rely on them. Where critical scholars are questioning about these power dynamics and its implications and what sort of dogma it's promoting through the usage of these tools. So a really great piece to check out at gcml.org if you get a chance.
Thank you, everyone. I'm Alicia Wajardo, and that is the news that did not make the news.
All right, Alicia, great work. All right, we're going to take a short musical break. When we come back, we are going to talk to Caitlin Remmel. Next on the Project Censored Show, we'll be talking to Caitlin Remmel of the Incorruptibles and Brand New Congress. Caitlin is originally from the San Francisco Bay Area, where she is heavily involved with the Bernie Sanders campaign, volunteering as an event organizer. Caitlin currently volunteers for progressive organizations like Brand New Congress, Justice Democrats, the Incorruptibles, Spaceship Media, and Living Room Conversations.
Caitlin, you have been working with Brand New Congress and numerous other organizations, and you were involved with the Bernie Sanders campaign here. In fact, you introduced him at one of his rallies in the Bay Area. So welcome to the show. Why don't you start by telling people what is going on with Brand New Congress?
Thank you so much for having me. Brand New Congress is a really exciting experiment, something we are trying with this political revolution that we have going on in our country right now. What our goal is we're targeting the year 2018, and we're running a slate of 400-plus candidates for Congress with the idea that everyone is on a unified progressive platform, and we'll be running it from a national strategical level, but with 400-plus different specific races. And these are the people we will be running are local leaders of their community. So the idea is that we're trying to re-elect Congress with people that are actual, real representatives of their community and people who actually want to fight for their constituents and do what's best for the country.
Right. Now, Caitlin, so just to clarify for people, so really this movement, Brand New Congress, it grew out of, what was it, just pre-Trump election, or was it right around the election when essentially people got together and said, which they've been saying now for years, which is that this Congress does not work for the people. There is money in politics. There is immense corruption. It is a Tea Party kind of fueled momentum that has taken over and pretty much wants to disembowel our government more than establish any kind of regulations or help rein in corporate power. What was the idea really behind Brand New Congress to basically replace and say they all need to go? I mean, there are progressives, there's other good ones there, but what was the fundamentals of this group when it started?
Yeah, so really, one of the fundamentals is really actually what you touched on, which is the corrupt money and the corrupt politicians that we have just throughout our entire government. And so by running candidates that are picked not only by the people, but then also funded by the people, all through small dollar donations, we are not a super PAC. We are just a regular federal regulated PAC that has a lot of limits and regulations on donations. So we are funded completely by the people. So then the candidates would actually, when they're in office, be fighting for their constituents. So that's really what we are based on originally, is this idea is inspired by the Bernie Sanders campaign. Being able to find an honest politician that is genuine and cares about the people that he's representing. We just took a look at that and realized we want more of that. We want more people like that in our Congress and in our federal government. And regardless of who is in the White House, we need to have a strong Congress behind them to really be working for the people, because not one person can do it alone.
Caitlin, this is Dr. Baham. I'm wondering, even when we find good candidates and people who are representing the values of the people in this country, how do we manage to get these people elected in sort of a post-Civil Rights Act world that we're in, post-Voting Rights Act in particular? This election that we just had is the first election that we've had since the passage of the Voting Rights Act, in which the Voting Rights Act itself was neutered.
One of the ways that we can really accomplish this is by spreading the word now and getting just a huge turnout for our midterm elections. Because the reality is, when we're looking at voter fraud, when we're looking at all of the corrupt money that is used to spend on campaigns, the reality is that voter turnout can really help to overcome any of this. So when enough people are showing up at the polls to vote for the candidate that they really want in office, just it really does show that we can overcome anything. The other thing that's really exciting is when we're looking at 400 races, like if we look at just the Bernie campaign during the primaries, he won over 20 states throughout the country. He won by a landslide in so many districts. So if we can just get some of our candidates elected just in those specific districts, I mean, even if we can just get 30 of our candidates elected in 2018, then that will really go a long way and just help us build even more momentum to continue every 2 years to continue with this fight.
Caitlin, this is Dr. Nolan Higdon. I was kind of on a similar point that you're talking about here. From my experience in studying media, people tend to not want to discuss or look at voter fraud. It scares people because it reveals some scary foundations of our democratic process. And so I'm just wondering, as an organization, do you guys take that into account? Like, how do we expose this, make people aware of it, and then, of course, resist it and combat it? So is that a center, anywhere in your guys' purview of trying to change the way Congress behaves?
Great question. I think the biggest way that we want to look at combating it, and yes, we definitely do talk about it, and it's something that's brought up a lot, if anything, just by our supporter base. And I think really what a lot of our vision is and our goal is that even if voter fraud is not specifically in our platform, just same with the way that voting is regulated and campaign spending or anything like that, our goal is that by getting these candidates into office who, again, want to actually represent the will of the people, they will make the right decisions and come together as a group to make any laws or reform that needs to be changed in our system. So the biggest way that right now that we want to look at overcoming it is by having that turnout, having that amount of landslide support that we really need. And then in addition, once we actually get our candidates in office, then they will be able to put some things in place to actually make those changes far more lasting.
So, Caitlin, it sounds so straightforward. It sounds real like what so many people in the country are saying. It's what Trump's election has now driven people to this conclusion, if the Tea Party elections before it didn't already, which is we need our own people in office. We need to take back government and take back Congress. What?
Absolutely.
But so it sounds like a straightforward thing. What are these candidates? How do you put out the notice? What is the message you send for the kind of people? I mean, if you want to have Bernie type people, but say who are decades younger and who will be in office for many years, hopefully, and who come and represent, say, even the millennial generation and people in their 20s and 30s, you don't have to have, I think it's really looking for young, new blood to come in. What's the strategy to find those people and encourage them to step up?
Absolutely. So the biggest thing is we are asking the country to nominate people in their communities. So we have asked our supporter base, we are throughout the country, we have gotten well over 5,000 nominations, if not higher than that at this point over the last several months. So we're asking our supporter base and just everyone possible to nominate someone that they think of that they would love to be the person representing them in Congress. And then from there, we have a strong vetting process that our working group is looking at when looking at these nominations, looking at demographically if this person is a good representative of their community, looking at what have they been able to build in their community, what are ways that they have stood up to corruption or bureaucracy in the past. And then in addition, what industries that they have been a part of. And then, of course, also what are their political views as well in terms of how progressive they are. What's nice is by looking at this slate of 400 candidates, as we're compiling this large puzzle of people, we're going to be able to look at, great, what are we looking at in terms of demographics, in terms of race and age and industries that people have experience in, as well as religion, as well as gender. And so across the board, we're hoping to put together a slate of candidates that demographically is actually representative of our country, because we have right now we've been able to identify all of the districts where there are a lot of white male Republican Christian men in our Congress right now. And not that that's a bad thing by any means, because we definitely have plenty of those types of citizens throughout the country, but proportionately it is not accurate right now, and it is not a good representation of what actually makes our country up.
Yeah. So tell me also, tell listeners what Justice Democrats, what is this new fusion that's taken place with brand new Congress and the Young Turks, I believe, from the media organization with Cenk Uygur. What is that, Justice Democrats?
Justice Democrats comes from the idea that the fundamental anger that a lot of people have had specifically with the Democratic Party and how corrupt the Democratic Party has been with everything when it comes to voter fraud and being very dishonest and just corrupt throughout. And so a lot of people are looking at, just specifically on the Democratic side, how can we take back the party? Because it's a party that is supposedly supposed to be working for the people. So where brand new Congress is postpartisan and will be planning to run both Republicans and Democrats, depending on what makes sense for the district, there's a lot of people that really just want to be focused on the Democratic side of the race and rebuilding the party. So that's where Justice Democrats has come into play. And Justice Democrats has formed with this idea of building a slate of candidates specifically on the Democratic side to really infiltrate and take back the party so that it's working for the people. So Justice Democrats and Brandon Congress have formed a very close partnership. And so Democratic candidates that are put forward by brand new Congress will be endorsed in the same as the Justice Democrat candidates as well. So we're working together with the nomination. So we're not getting in each other's way. So wherever we overlap, we are sharing resources. I actually personally volunteer for both. We have a lot of volunteers that are working with both organizations.
That's wonderful. Caitlin, can you give a website where people can go to so they can find out and plug in?
JusticeDemocrats.com is where you can go to look up that. And then in addition, we have brandnewcongress.org. You can nominate candidates, you can have a chance to donate, or you can fill out a survey that tells us about your community. So that way we can make sure that we're actually finding representatives that represent their communities.
Thank you, Caitlin Rimmel with Brand New Congress and other organizations. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio, and we will return after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III, and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin.
This time we want to welcome Charlotte Hill O'Neill, a.k.a. Mama C. She's a visual artist and spoken word artist, musician, longtime community activist, former Black Panther, and co-director of United African Alliance Community Center, the UAACC, that is based in Tanzania, East Africa. Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show, Mama C.
Thank you so much.
It's very good to hear your voice. For people who are just getting familiar with you, we want to give you a little bit of time to sort of explain your beginnings in the Black Panther Party.
Yes, yes. Well, I was born and raised in Kansas City, Kansas, and was always interested in African history. And then in the late 60s, I started hearing about the Black Panther Party here in Kansas City. Started seeing things on TV and in the newspapers, and I even had cut out some articles and clippings and pasted them to the wall of my bedroom. And I never realized that I would actually meet, let alone become the wife of the founder of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panther Party, Brother Pete O'Neill. So I started going to the political education classes, and then I started going to the Breakfast for School Children program. And then I signed on the dotted line. And, you know, before you join, you had to read certain books and you had to learn certain things. And I passed all the tests and became a full-fledged member of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panther Party.
And I know you have a very unique perspective on the international organization of the Black Panther Party. Could you share that a little bit with our audience?
Yes, yes. You know, I think most of your listeners know about COINTELPRO, which was the counterintelligence insurgency program that was initiated by the FBI, I think in the 50s. And there was a focus on the Black Panther Party and other progressive organizations in the 60s and early 70s, and many of the leaders were targeted and jailed and for things that they could not have done, and some were even killed. Well, my husband, Pete O'Neill, was one of the targeted leaders, and he was charged with carrying a gun across state lines. And anybody who knows about Kansas City knows that there is, in some places, there literally is a line in the middle of the road that separates Kansas City, Kansas, from Kansas City, Missouri. And there are so many hunters here, and everyone would cross state lines. But the thing about it is, he didn't do it. The thing about it is, they never even found him with this weapon. They found another Panther with it, actually. It had been sold by the police and had to be bought back after he was brought to trial. So he was charged with this, carrying a gun across state lines. He was convicted. He was given 4 or 5 years, I don't remember. And then there were two other charges that were lined up. We decided to leave and thought we would be back in 2 years. You know, there was what I like to term a modern-day underground railroad in those days, where people all around the world would help Black Panthers, would help other revolutionaries to go into exile for whether it was going to be a short time, a short period, or a long time. Well, we had help on this modern-day underground railroad and left and ended up in Algeria, Algiers, Algeria, which was the site of the international section of the Black Panther Party and was founded by Brother Eldridge Cleaver and some other comrades who were there. We lived there for 2 years, and I tell you, Brother, the camaraderie there was just beautiful. It was really, we were a family. It was very similar in all chapters of the Black Panther Party. No matter where you went, you were considered a comrade and family member. So here I was, 19 years old then, almost 20, living in a country that I knew nothing about, living in a different culture. It was the Islamic culture there. I knew nothing about that. But the fact that we had so much support from the Algerian government, the National Front for Liberation, and the fact that there were revolutionaries from all over the world there that we interacted with made it a very easy situation. Matter of fact, it was a beautiful situation. I learned so much there, and that's where our first child, Malcolm, was born. Also in the hills of Medea, like 60 miles outside of Algeria.
You are listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, and we are talking to Mama C. And Mama C, a moment ago you spoke about the COINTEL program and how the government had created this infrastructure to blockade the successful activism and progressivism of the Black Panther Party. I'm wondering what your view is, given today, how that infrastructure has dramatically expanded, especially in the digital era and the increase of the military state. Are you optimistic about still the people power to resist the regime's ability to surveil and manipulate the courts? And if you are optimistic, what is it that keeps you optimistic?
Wow. You know, this is a whole different ball game, of course, as you mentioned, because of the digital age. You know, I mean, we were working with mimeograph machines then. But, you know, that's a two-edged sword, I think, because people can use that to their advantage in order to reach more people on the social network. You know, and I maintain that as long as there are cadres of people in communities across America and across the world who still have progressive ideals, who still have the upliftment of their communities in their minds and in their heart, I think that things will still improve. Maybe not on a large scale, but there are pockets of people, there are cadres of people who are taking, for instance, the education of their children into their own hands. You know, you have community schools, you have people who are homeschooling. You know, you have people who are looking at urban farming as a way to not only provide much needed food in these food deserts that are all across the country, but also as a means of building community, you know. So yeah, I'll never give up hope. I will never give up hope. I think resistance will continue, but we do have to find other means.
Mama C, this is Michael Leviton hopping in. What would you say, responding to Black Lives Matter and their role, that group's role? Couldn't quite call it a group or organization. It is a vast potential, really. I mean, it could go in so many ways, that movement. Where do you think that they could find the footing for that movement to help lead in this new Trump law and order period?
Well, you know, I say much respect and salute to Black Lives Matter and other progressive organizations like that. I mean, they are so, so needed. I think they are an example for so many people. They have awakened so many people, and because of that, it has forced people to come together, to wake up, to educate each other, to resist. You know, so organizations like Black Lives Matter continue to be needed, and I think that there will be tentacles of that movement that will spread to other communities. And, you know, I think they're setting a very, very good example.
You know, I wanted to ask you along those lines, this is Dr. Bayham again, to the degree to which you as a Black Panther soldier feel that the Black Lives Matter movement is a natural outgrowth of the Black Panther Party. And in particular, I'm thinking about the sort of Black queer woman activist who is at the head, who are at the heads of many of the Black Lives Matter chapters. If you see that as an outgrowth of the activism of Black women in the Black Panther Party, like yourself.
Of course it is, because, you know, that was one of our tenets, that we work with everybody. Everyone had the right to progress in their lives and to build their lives. And back in the day, it wasn't that popular to recognize, you know, the queer community, but the Black Panther Party always did. The way we recognize everyone and the way we work with everyone, you know, when I go to these different schools, I always like to emphasize the fact that, you know, the news media tried to depict us as a racist organization, where we were anything but that, you know. We worked with all progressive people to build our community. Of course, our focus was on our Black community, but we understood that we do have allies, whether they were in the white community, red community, brown community, or yellow community, or the purple community, the queer community, you know. So to me, that does not even enter into the fact that it was started by some queer sisters, you know. If you have your head on right, if your heart is in the right place, then I say right on to that.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We will be back with Mama C after this short musical break.
Friends too, because it's getting nearer, it soon will be with you. Oh, come and join the living, it's not so far from you, and it's getting nearer, soon it will all be true. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III, and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. We are talking to Mama C.
Mama C, this is Dr. Bayham again. I know that you're back in the United States for another national tour and are going to be speaking about the United African Alliance Community Center. We wanted to give you a little bit of an opportunity to talk about the things that you're going to be sharing with the audiences that you encounter during your current national tour.
Well, you know, I always like to speak on the history of the Black Panther Party and how it was such a means to uplift the community and join us together. But love to focus also on the fact that in Tanzania, at the United African Alliance Community Center, or you can say UAACC, that we're carrying on the work of the Black Panther Party, the community service of the Black Panther Party, and we are so proud of that, that we've been able to do that for more than 40 years, despite the fact that Brother Pete continues to be in exile. And I always like to tell people that the fact that we're able to do that, the fact that we have been able to continue that community service, to me, that is the greatest revenge.
So, Mama C, where can people go to find out about the specific dates of where you'll be, and what can they expect when they go out to see you?
Well, I will be posting that on my Facebook page and on our website, which is at www.uaacc.net. But I haven't posted yet. I will be doing that very, very soon. My Facebook page is very active. That's Charlotte Hill O'Neill. And people can find out a lot about that. I also, you know, I'm a musician also, and I'm a poet. So I have a lot of my work on SoundCloud, a lot of my work on YouTube, and I'm a filmmaker also. I'll be showing a couple of films, not only that I have made myself, but films that have been about our work, including one, A Panther in Africa by Aaron Matthews. People can see that on PBS TV also. And another one called A Mama C, Urban Warrior in the African Bush by Dr. Joanne Hirschfield.
Mama C, just wondering if there's any chance that you have any of your poetry that you'd be willing to share with us at this moment.
You know, as a matter of fact, I was looking through my book right now. So as we talk, let me continue looking for something that isn't too long, because I know we don't have a whole lot of time.
That sounds good. So while you're looking, too, you know, maybe you can find something that is particularly relevant to the conversation that we've had up to this point. I haven't actually directly asked you about your take on a topic that we've been discussing quite a bit today, that is the rise of American authoritarianism in the Trump era.
You know, it's blowing my mind. It really is. You know, during the campaign, I just very naively, I just really, really thought that he would not be elected. You know, and I kept saying this is just a distraction, you know, and they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes as something else is going on. And now he's really here. You know, and people who voted for him, I think they're saying, oops, we made a big mistake, you know. And I just really, in my heart, I don't think that he's going to last much longer as far as being able to govern. It's just too many discrepancies in what he's trying to do, and people are really waking up, people in Congress and I guess people in the Senate, you know. So it's blowing my mind that this has really happened. And, you know, a lot of your listeners have probably read the book 1984, you know, and we're really living in the era of 1984, of George Orwell's 1984. But like I said before, in many ways, this causes people to come together, you know. So we have to always, like Obama used to say, we have to always take the high road and look for ways that we can turn this negative situation into something that is positive.
Mama C, this is Michael Levitin again. I don't know if you were tuned in. Donald Trump's assertions at a large press conference talking about the Congressional Black Caucus, and he seemed pretty caught out. I guess he'd been trying to arrange some meetings, but the caucus didn't want to meet with him. They hadn't really had much success at communication. And the interviewer, the journalist in the audience said, you know, what really is your plan? Are you going to follow through? Because really, he seems to be telling America, and of course, many of us know not to believe the vast majority of what he's telling us, but he seems to think that Black America really did, in largish numbers, larger than we expected, as he says, voted for him and somehow expects Trump to come out and take the side of what he calls our carnage-ridden inner cities. What he plans to do is a mystery to anyone. I mean, do you see it as his case is just disingenuous and, again, pulling the wool over? Or do you think he has anything to offer?
I really don't. I really, really, really don't. And that's very, very sad. You know, he doesn't have anyone on his team that would have the interests of not only Black people, but any of the communities that he is supposed to serve in his focus, you know, any upliftment of communities. And when I look at who the person who's the head of the education, did she get elected? I mean, did she get appointed?
Betsy DeVos is in, yes.
With an unprecedented vote cast by the vice president, had never happened in U.S. history to break the tie.
That's some scary stuff right there, especially when you look at one of the first things that they started doing was taking away funds for all these urban schools and taking away funds for the art programs and things like that. You know, it's all by design. It's all by design. It's all to destroy the communities, the little bit of things that are left. And that is so sad. But on the other hand, this is forcing people to start homeschooling their children. It's forcing people to start their own community schools. You know, but I saw on the internet recently that this sister had taken her child out of school to homeschool her child, and the authorities came, arrested her, put the child in foster care, and I think she's locked up. I couldn't believe it.
Yes. Mama C, we may have actually run out of time for a poem from you, but we've been able to give our listeners, do we have at least 1 minute, Nolan?
We have 1 minute. We have a little part.
Mama C, maybe a stanza.
I have a short something, okay?
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, we are the knowers. We are the dreamers, and we are the soars, indigo children, the teachers and the preachers. We are the chosen, we are the artists, and we are the seekers, and we walk the way of the new world. Yeah, that's what we do.
Thank you so much, Mama C.
It's amazing. Thank you so much for being on the program. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Y'all take care here.
You too.
All power to the people.
Power to the people.
Aye. Bye-bye.
Bye. Next week on the Project Censored Show, we'll be interviewing Alexander Reed Ross about his book, Against the Fascist Creep. Here is an excerpt of that conversation.
Well, Trump became sort of leader of the wingnut Tea Party branch of birthers. And from there, he gained a significant right-wing reactionary following, which he was able to parlay into his presidential bid. And through that campaign, he became kind of a figurehead for a lot of Nazis and traditionalists and old school Southern neo-Confederates. And so it was through that coalition, if you will, of fascists that Trump was able to really compete for presidency and eventually win.
How would you explain fascism to someone? We've had some discussion about the term and its different usages. How would you explain the term to someone?
Well, I definitely agree with what's called the new consensus that was developed in the early 90s, that fascism actually does have an ideology. It's not just pure irrationalism. However, the ideology itself is fundamentally based on deception and lies. So it's basically a mythopoetic ideology. Create its own myth, its own alt universe, alternative universe of alt facts. And through this sort of dimension, it calls for a rebirth of the classical nation, right? So in this sense, I personally have said that Make America Great Again is very similar to this, what technically known as palingenetic ultranationalism. However, since Trump never fully agreed with the idea publicly of creating a white ethnostate in the United States, he is really sort of on the outskirts, the margins of linkages and networks between the radical right and fascism itself.
And Alexander, this is Michael Levitin jumping in here. So how do you see the element of spectacle? I think that was really key in that, if nothing else, that anyone tuning in, and Americans notoriously are not very tuned in to global events, certainly, and a lot of the time domestic ones, everyone was able to see the spectacle. They saw it with Bernie Sanders as well. They saw lots of crowds and tons of enthusiasm, but it was a whole other level and a style that you could pick up just by watching anything televised by Trump during his campaign. And the idea of mockery and humor and showboating and kind of a guy who gets up there and will make the audience laugh by, you know, denigrating this person, that group. I mean, that also harkens back to traditional kind of Nazi. That's what Hitler and Goebbels and the early Nazi creators did, isn't it? Becoming a spectacle and a show for the public.
Absolutely. However, it's also what people like George Wallace did, and there was a fair amount of violence as well that followed George Wallace around. Joe Lowndes, who's a really great scholar currently teaching at the University of Oregon, has a book about the Southern strategy where he discusses how the violence outside of George Wallace's campaign events actually helped his campaign gain some momentum because, like you're saying, it became part of the spectacle. And this is also true of Jean-Marie Le Pen in France during the 80s and 90s, perhaps. So that sort of demagoguery, if you will, is a tried and true political tradition. And really with Trump, it was hyperbole, right? Everything is the best thing ever. You know, nothing is quite thought through and the nuance is completely lost. It's either everybody should feel completely comfortable with him and the reality that he's spinning on the one hand, or everybody should feel completely terrified and terrorized by anybody who speaks against Trump and unsettles the sort of status quo. So that sort of thing, that sort of spectacle, I think, was important, especially in the midst of a divided country, because it is a divided country. So Trump really plays to people's emotions, and he builds his audience, like you're saying, by scapegoating people and so on. So it is absolutely something that, say, your Hitler or Mussolini would have done, and this is a comparison that's made over and again. However, it's not restricted to them. It's generally sort of a populist political strategy or technique, rather.
Alexander, this is Dr. Baham. I'm wondering, you mentioned George Wallace, but I wonder if you could elaborate some of the other past discursive formations that really lay the groundwork for Trump's white ethno-nationalist government. And then if you could also kind of talk about the role that Steve Bannon plays in making this all happen.
Yes, absolutely. I think that takes us pretty nicely from the national level to the international level, because when you look at Trump, we're really talking about Americanism. I've argued that Americanism, as thinkers of populism like Cass Mudd have shown, really kind of begins in the 1830s, 1840s with the Know-Nothings, who are a sort of bizarre populist kind of group that really shunned immigrants in particular and cultivated this understanding of what is American, who is the true American, who really believes in America, and how do we define Americanism as opposed to immigrants in particular.
We want land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. It's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital.
We've been listening to Project Censored Radio today. It's now 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, the Recovery Zone looks at the benefits of soil carbon sequestration and regenerative agriculture. Stay tuned for all that and more coming up on KBOO, your community radio. We appreciate you listening and becoming a member of KBOO today. That would be great. Just go to kboo.fm and click where it says donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 27th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, taking place Thursdays through Sundays until March 4th at PCC Cascade in Portland. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a Vision of Africa package for Western viewers. The films celebrate